together around climate and climate justice issues. The Oregon Just Transition, the Oregon Just Transition Assembly, which is part of the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, which just launched this year, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, it was brought together with four frontline community organizations and.
Keep going.
I think when I came on to OPAL as the executive director, we really wanted to examine the strengths of our organization. We organize and build power for environmental justice and civil rights in low-income communities and communities of color, and looking at the broad intersections of a wide range of issues, and climate justice was one of those issues. We think that this was an opportunity to bring together different impacted communities that maybe haven't actually used an environmental justice lens or climate justice as a core issue to actually be in a space to explore a wide range of the intersectionality. It actually, was a big reason why we built out and decided to put on the People's Climate Movement March back in April of 29th of this year, putting frontline communities and drawing the intersectionalities of immigration as a climate justice issue, addressing white supremacy as a climate justice issue, food security as a climate justice issue, housing, transportation. I think those are intersectional, and I think we want to bring our whole selves to the space, particularly when we're trying to build movements of movements. This weekend was an opportunity, and of course, we can always grow and be better, and there's other people with missing voices, of course. But I think it was just a start of a conversation to engage communities around their whole selves in building out a vision to move from this extractive, exploitive economy to one that's regenerative and with deep democracy and cooperation.
We have more questions about the Just Transition Assembly, but first we heard that we already have a caller on the air.
Wow, 810 caller. That's
yeah. Who do we have on the air? Hey, Camilo.
Good morning, Joseph. Good morning, Shilpa. Good morning, Huey.
Morning.
Good morning.
I was at the assembly, and it was truly amazing, inspiring. What I think is important for us to realize about this is that this is not just resistance, but people coming together to do positive things. And I want to announce an opportunity to advance that possibility of people coming together to work on the positive. And that is an event called Stand Together Under One Roof, which is going to be on October 14th at the Rose City Park Presbyterian Church. It's a chance for over 100 different community organizations involved in environmentalism, racial justice, social justice, to meet and to share their programs and to exchange information with one another and the general public.
Camila, we'll definitely announce that again by the end of the show. Do you have a question for Hui or Shilpa?
No, I just wanted to announce this and make sure that all of the organizations that would be interested are aware of it and have an opportunity to participate.
Sounds good. Camilo, thanks for the call this morning, and we'll definitely make sure we shout this out at the end of the show. I think it's great to have places for folks to come together to convene, and already looking ahead to the next thing is really critical. Back to the Just Transition Assembly. So just to give us some of the sense of who is there? How many people? Where did you all meet? How did folks get together? Because was it just a big Portland thing? Was it a state thing? Give us a little bit more of the background, and Shilpa, I want to hear your thoughts in a minute, too.
Sure.
Yeah. Where we held it is actually also pretty critical. We were able to, through our good relationships over at NAYA, the Native American Youth and Family Center, we were able to be able to hold the assembly on their sacred land, where we have to recognize who we are in this state, and when we talk about frontline communities, having indigenous voices is critical to developing the vision for a more just society and a more just economy. So we actually held it over at NAYA. We had over 200 folks registered, and they participated in some deep dives around a wide range of issues. We explored the three main crises that are facing our communities right now, the crisis of empire, the ecological crisis, and the economic crisis. And these were just some pillars that we, you know, had some deep dives, talked about how do we end the bad, talking about the extractive economy where we dig, burn, and dump in, you know, environmental justice communities, people of color, and low-income communities, and exploit the labor of folks in those communities.
So, 200 folks came together to talk about the crisis of empire, the ecological and economic crises. Again, who are these folks? Like, are these just like other organizers, or, you know, talk about the base building that was happening?
The Oregon Just Transition Alliance is bringing together frontline communities. And we didn't want to just bring just the organizers or the executive directors. We really wanted to support groups that are doing organizing and base building in communities. So we wanted the assembly to reflect that. So we asked, you know, organizations to bring their members. So we had, you know, transit riders. We have farm workers. We have day laborers. We have immigrant folks and students. Young folks from bases that people are organizing, a wide range of folks, indigenous communities are organizing in and out of Portland. We had our good friends from Rogue Climate come up. They did the long drive.
Southern Oregon.
Southern Oregon. They're doing amazing work down there and, you know, battling some tough issues as well. So it was pretty exciting. You know, we had folks come out from La Grande. You know, this space actually allowed us to find out what organizing is happening in other places of Oregon that we actually currently didn't know because we were facing so many things in Portland. As we were reaching out and looking at what's happening across the state of Oregon, being able to actually hear about some of the great stuff happening.
So the Oregon Just Transition Assembly brought together frontline folks, folks who are really directly affected and going to feel the deeper sort of impacts of climate justice. But it sounds like you also did some deep analysis building, some ability to understand the issues and the connections between issues. And Shilpa, really curious to some of your takeaways from the day. You talked about having sort of a real sense of community and a sense of solidarity with other communities. Can you say more about what it was like for you?
Yeah, so I've learned about the concept of just transition over the years. And one of the things that was really exciting about this assembly was that it was in the Oregon context. So with all the people that are working on campaigns and fights in their communities, we surfaced so much knowledge at a really like personal and, you know, micro location specific. So we had people from outside of the state that were facilitating the process that were, everyone was having a lot of aha moments about how things are so connected. One of the exercises that I thought was the most powerful was we put up a really big piece of paper along one of the walls, and we just mapped out all of the struggles that we're having with the extractive economy in Oregon. Where from the pipeline and no LNG fighters in Southern Oregon to people suffering along highways in our state, a lot of our environmental justice communities live within a mile of major highways because our emissions from the pollution from the transportation sector are so high in our state. About 40% of our emissions come from the transportation sector. And so we're drawing a lot of parallels. And of course, in drawing parallels with the fights that we are engaged in, we drew a lot of the similar root causes. You know, power collects, especially recently in the last few decades, power is in fewer and fewer hands, and wealth is in fewer and fewer hands. And you're seeing that play out on a global level, definitely on a national level, and of course on a state level. So it was empowering to find that even though we started with all these disparate you know, fights and campaigns that we were engaged in, we really did have a lot of the same opponents, the same targets, the same institutions that we were ultimately working to fight. And then we had all these people in the room that were doing it, and so our power was with us. So that was really inspiring. Another big takeaway for me is this concept of meaningful work. So I think in the West, something that we've really struggled with, my culture, my family's from India, and there's a really disparate set of values when it comes to how we value people in our society. I think in the West we have sort of toxic connection with the idea that a person is only worth, is only a functioning member of society if they can put in 40 hours a week. It really leaves out a lot of our most vital members of our community, our young people, our children, our elders, differently abled folks. Mm-hmm. Those are all vital members of our community, and we need to respect them and have space for them. So we spent a lot of time talking more philosophically, actually, and it was really great to have that space about how to redefine work and how to redefine value in our societies as so it's not tied to the labor that you can contribute to a capitalist system.
If you're listening in right now and you want to call in and join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. This is Voices from the Edge. I'm Joseph Santos-Lyons. I'm here with Hui Yang and Shilpa Joshi. We're talking about climate justice and the Oregon Just Transition Assembly that just happened Labor Day weekend here in Portland at the Native American Youth and Family Center. Hui.
Yeah, we'd love to just also add that it was an opportunity that's very rare in Oregon where folks of color from these bases and these organizations get a chance to be in a room over a weekend. We actually intentionally, you know, had invitations to, you know, make sure that the room was filled with voices that are often silenced. And, you know, we wanted to actually, you know, bring in more folks, and it was just a tough weekend. But I know there's lots of, like, white allies out there that, you know, wanted to also be a part of the space. And we're very thankful and grateful that folks respected, you know, the leadership of frontline communities wanting to hold an intentional space for folks to, you know, dive deep in conversations. And we actually held a different space with our friends over at Surge, showing up for racial justice. They held combating white supremacy training in a different space, where we actually directed folks that wanted to be a part of the assembly. By respecting that space, they, you know, folks went over and learned about, you know, doing some deep dives around white supremacy. And
excellent.
And it was super exciting just that, you know, folks, you know, filled that room. There's like 60 folks in the other room.
That's great. Oregon has such a legacy of environmental activism and has been on the forefront of a lot of fights around freeway expansion in the 60s and 70s, and maybe again in the 2010s and 2020s. The LNG fight that Shilpa just mentioned, efforts to preserve. And, you know, this really feels like a big pivot around environmental issues to be thinking about it from a deeper, broader perspective around the extractive economy, the concepts of empire, and this idea of dig, burn, and dump. Can you say a little bit more about the dig, burn, and dump and the extractive economy? What does that really mean for folks who may have not really heard about our economy put in that particular frame of extractive?
I would love to see what Shilpa took away from it as a participant.
Okay. I'm not being tested right now.
No.
For me, I think starting my organizing in Washington, D.C., you see a lot of the, you're on sort of the front lines of the extractive economy. You have oil refineries, you have chemical refineries, you have trash incinerators, which are a thing of the past, thankfully, in the state of Oregon, still being constructed today in Maryland, that they're still fighting to not construct. So I think 3 years ago, if you had told me what state needed to really be fighting back against the extractive economy, Oregon would not have been high on my list. Mm-hmm. And then as we were fighting a fracked gas export facility in the Chesapeake Bay at Cove Point, we found out that Rogue Climate was starting in Southern Oregon, in my home state, to fight a fracked gas export facility at Jordan Cove. And all of a sudden I realized that empire has no bounds, and that there's no such thing as a green state, and that, you know, there will be exit points for our extractive economy, and one of those happens to be Coos Bay, and that they're trying to build now. And so that really brought the fight home for me. I think, as you said, Oregon has this history of environmental activism, but I really struggle with who has been able to be a part of that fight and who has been left out. And I think one of the most inspiring things about the activism that's happening now is that not only is it incorporating more voices and more communities really representative of the whole state, but it's actually calling out the true history of our state, that it was a state grounded and built in white supremacy, that we that we are all living on stolen land, that we have to acknowledge these truths of our own history as we go forward in building our fight against the extractive economy. So across the state, while we may not have the oil refineries, we are seeing that we have a lot of truck traffic, a lot of diesel pollution, as I said. We are fighting massive pipeline. The pipeline fight that will cut through southern Oregon goes through sacred native land. It crosses 400 plus waterways, and that's all to trigger a massive amount of fracking in Colorado, in Wyoming, and other places that are already so encumbered by that industry, simply by creating an exit point from the United States in Coos Bay. And so we have a significant responsibility to not gloss over those challenges that our state faces by just saying that we're a green state or that we've, you know, done our fair share of environmental activism, because then the extractive economy, the empire, continues to take advantage of us.
We have another caller on the air, but first I just want to say that was a powerful overview and really begins to sort of connect the dots, I think, in a really more explicit way about how, you know, whether or not we see Oregon as a place where maybe we've got things going well, we're still potentially complicit in terms of what's happening around the massive climate shift, climate change that's happening here in this country. We have another caller on the air, John. LJ, welcome. What's your question?
First of all, thank you for the show. Really good dialogue. You young folks, it's your world, and I hope you don't screw it up like we did. All right, so here's the deal. Can we talk about Harvey and Houston and the fact that there is no zoning laws in Houston? So refineries and these chemical plants could drop themselves in the middle of residential neighborhoods, mostly people of color, who get affected with high cancer rates and like other maladies. It's also the law in Texas where the chemical plants do not have to divulge what they're putting into the air, because they're afraid if the terrorists find out what the chemical plants have, there might be havoc wreaked. And just one more point, and I'll get off the air. Port Arthur, Texas, Janis Joplin's hometown, by the way, the cancer rate there is so high that the folks who live there, mostly all Afro-Americans who come down with cancer, don't even bother to go for chemotherapy because they know they're only going to be alive for the next 4 or 5 months and they're going to die anyway. And just a response, and I'm sorry I am the doom and gloom, but anyway, have a great day.
LJ, thanks for the call.
And one more thing, Houston is the perfect example of a capitalist system. Keep on keeping on, y'all.
Thanks for the call, LJ. This is maybe a good transition for us to pivot back to and zoom out to what's happening in the larger world. You know, the massive hurricane in Texas, Hurricane Harvey, and now I think this week Hurricane Irma is already doing some major damage in the Caribbean and about to come on shore this weekend in Florida and southeast U.S. And some of these states, some of these cities, I think, as the news has been reporting, really either unprepared, and even if they were prepared, as LJ said, the zoning and the layout and the impacts of these major weather events, these extreme weather events, are really disproportionately affecting folks of color and some of those frontline communities that we've been talking about here in Oregon, having to really lead. So, Hui and Shilpa, curious your thoughts.
Yeah, it's devastating. I think, you know, seeing imagery and the stories that, you know, even mainstream media is kind of putting out there. I think I do want folks to also dig deeper into some of the narratives and stories that aren't being told. So I think you'll hear a lot of like stories of like suffering, people losing whole things, resilience. I think, you know, stories of hope are also very important. But we're also hearing that, you know, just on September 1st, and as the beginning of the first of the month, you know, landlords were asking for rent for people that actually could not live in the apartments.
Their homes are still underwater sometimes.
They're underwater, and you know, people have not been able to work. So there's like this intersection around, you know, the environmental impacts, the devastation of economically, and I think the narratives and storytelling is so important because, you know, those are things that are often, you know, brushed under, and drawing out the intersectionality of, you know, people and their whole lives, and, you know, bringing them whole selves into the picture is really important because, you know, as we're building out a new economy, and we look all over the U.S. and globally, the decisions we make here has impact, you know, on folks in other places. You know, so I think those are challenging things to, you know, lift up and, you know, amplify, right, as we build out more narratives that talks about a vision of a world that, you know, keeps things in the ground, that we do not need to dig up, and actually have frontline communities, those that are most directly impacted, actually shifting power.
Yeah, thanks for that, Hui. I've been thinking a lot about displacement this week and talking to people at Renew Oregon and my community about displacement. It's a theme I keep coming back to. Who gets to leave when things get bad, and who has to stay whether they want to or not? And then with the news on DACA, who has to leave and has nowhere safe to go? And just these themes of displacement, whether they're political or environmental, are really playing out exactly along the lines that our systems and our country have been built on, to protect those with access and power and wealth, and to leave behind those without those things. And so Hurricane Harvey for me, I think definitely was probably a wake-up call for Houston is a capital of industry. It's a capital of the fossil fuel industry.
Enron. Think, was based there.
Yeah. There's a lot of offices that are, you know, we saw the stock market tank and those things I don't really pay attention to, but others do. I think it was a wake-up call for folks that have maybe been trying to ignore how interconnected all these issues are for some time. And then the news of Irma has really hit heavy on my heart. I have really close friends in Florida. I spent some time there, and I've been talking to people constantly about getting out. And again, there's people that can't leave. They have elders in their family that can't be moved. They don't have the resources to leave. Some are working. They are first responders. I have two friends that are nurses that said, I'm not going to leave my home city and my home state when I know I'll be needed most. And one of them is pregnant. And I really think that in the days and weeks to come, for those that have any sort of privilege or access to resources, it is our, not just our responsibility, but it's our human, there's the human element to this that we have to, it's easy to bury your head in the sand when things feel hopeless, but the thing that makes me feel hopeful is actually doing something. And so I'm going to look around at the resources that my community has, that I personally have, the access that I have, and really direct those to people struggling to renew their DACA if possible, and putting together resources for that, money for that, and looking at what we can do to get in the streets. I think one of the things that I've also found a little frustrating is that Oregon has a lot of Democrats in Congress, and so we aren't calling them because we think that they just are on board with, you know, protecting DACA. That is a lot of complacency. I called Representative Blumenauer's office, and they hadn't actually gotten that many calls as of Tuesday morning, and I was really shocked by that. They will not act as boldly as we need them to unless we put pressure on them to do so. And so just as we have democratically elected officials in Congress, we have a responsibility in our state of not being the most on the front lines of the extractive economy, and having a Democratic governor and a Democratic majority in the House and Senate to really move the ball forward as much as we can in these times under the current federal administration. So I really do think resistance is connected in the face of all of this tragedy.
Absolutely. You're listening to Voices from the Edge. I'm Joseph Santos Lyons here with Shilpa Joshi and Hui Ong. We're talking about climate justice and the Oregon Just Transition Assembly that just happened this last Labor Day weekend. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call, 503-231-8187. I want to sort of begin to move to the next topic, but before we do, wanted to sort of think and hear from you, Hui, a little bit about what are some of the next steps after the big gathering that happened, the 200 plus folks from frontline communities looking at a more comprehensive view of shifting Oregon away from the extractive economy and into a more restorative and renewable energy economy.
Yeah, and also want to just add that, you know, the way we ended the assembly, we actually had a direct action training on Labor Day weekend where, you know, as we learn, we cannot always depend on our electeds to, we should not depend on our electeds to make the decision that we know we need to be making for ourselves. And part of that is, you know, creating the skill sets that, can arm our communities to actually, do creative actions, do interventions. The reason DACA actually passed wasn't because, President Obama had a change of heart. It was made because, youth and undocumented folks, sat in Colorado and people did direct action. And I think it's a critical skill sets that I think more folks of color in our communities need to be supported. And we were lucky and fortunate enough to have the Ruckus Society and the Indigenous People's Power Project come out and create that direct action training for us. It's, can't do all the direct action training in one day. I think there's other opportunities we're going to try to look forward in the months to come to, bring folks back and other trainers to deepen our skill sets, have more practice, because there's a lot of things, we're facing. There's a quote-unquote Patriot Prayer that, was scheduled, I believe, on Sunday of this week. I think we're trying to confirm if that's still happening. There's folks that are going to be engaged in mobilizing around that, but then there's also some other folks that actually want to figure out what are some of the creative ways that frontline communities and folks of color can actually hold space together and show support and show that it's the responses need to be led by frontline communities. And I think there's tons of campaigns that people are moving, locally, statewide. I think part of it is that, we talked a lot about this LNG fight up and down this coast. A lot of people actually do not know about it. And I think there's actually a lot of questions around who supports it, who doesn't support it. I think there's some folks that actually we've taken for granted that they would, come out and support. And there's actually lots of Democrats that haven't. When I say support, I mean support the opposition of the pipeline being built. And there's actually a lot of like mainstream and virals that haven't come out. I'm not going to name no names, but it's actually really curious because, you would think that an issue that seems pretty clear about its impact on our communities, would be something that, or allied organizations we would believe would be on our side would come out in opposition. And, that's the level of, engagement that our folks need to be knowing what's happening on the ground and knowing the politics behind it. Because, for these things to actually be able to be resisted, it'll take more community engagement. So I think we're trying to create space for our membership and others along the Oregon Just Transition Alliance to do that deep dive and actually create opportunities for us to learn from each other's campaigns and draw the intersectionality. Folks are going to be doing stuff around immigration, stuff around DACA. There's the militarization of our transit system that we're addressing. This creep of white supremacy into our state. What are we doing to connect our campaigns to that, both the deeper analysis, but then also building up the skill sets of our communities to actually be able to strategically intervene and have impact on these ongoing campaigns.
And we're really in a time where I think everyone is feeling the impacts of the extractive economy, whether or not they know it by that name or not, from the hurricanes and the forest fires and the heat waves and the 9 days of missed school from the extreme ice and snow we had earlier this year. And I think what's interesting is to really begin to build this deeper analysis about how we are engaged or not engaged. Yeah, it just, mm-hmm. it feels like now is the time for us to be dreaming the biggest dreams possible. And these things may have felt impossible for whatever reason before, but now we need to have those impossible dreams more than ever. I remember when Tammy Bing Liu from the Labor Strategy Center came to Portland for one of our APANO events, and she was like, dream big or go home. And she's like, we're in Los Angeles, we're saying we want to envision a carless LA for all the reasons I think we're talking about here in terms of the mm-hmm. impacts on air quality and health and the environment. And I think if folks right now are looking for hope in this moment, it's about having a bigger, bolder dream for the world. And I really appreciate what y'all are both bringing to the conversation and the leadership you're offering. Great. So we've got two more callers. We're going to go ahead and take them real quick. Who's our first caller? Carolyn, welcome.
Thank you. Calling with an update on the Houston Tea perspective. One of my relatives lives 6 hours from work from Houston, and I understand there's not a whole lot of work being done in his office because people are talking about the problems with all the hurricane consequences. I thought that was extremely interesting. And another relative lives 4 hours away. He's also staying at, and that means that they have lived in their second story of their home. They sandbagged their home so that the water did actually not get into the house. And I thought that was impertinent for those who have relatives in that area, and they live 4 hours away.
Oh. Thank you, Carolyn.
Second story of home. And the one that's 6 hours away, everything is sort of copacetic, except for the fact that they have alligators in their backyard.
Oh, my gosh.
That the waters came up to the... Well, anybody that has seen nature films regarding that animal would have a bit of a perspective, but that was another unique communication or comment to me about the wildlife.
Carolyn, thanks so much for your call.
And also, the PS on the alligators is that they're being shipped to Louisiana. And the alligators that are coming up are not the old ones. They're more youthful. They're the younger ones. So that's all I can tell you.
Carolyn, and thanks so much for your call. We're going to go on to the next caller, but really wanted just to highlight what I think one thing you were saying that I'm taking away, which is the impact isn't just in Houston, but it's really expanding far beyond. And I know Galveston also is affected, and it's been affecting Louisiana even from Hurricane Harvey. Thank you for those personal stories. Let's go to our next caller, John. Dee Dee, welcome.
Hi. I've been wanting to say a lot of things, but most of which the guest and other callers said, so I'm so grateful. I wanted to ask that the teaching training materials, the content, and some of the info and concerns that came up in the trainings for frontline communities would also be shared with those of us who were at the White Allies training, and that information kind of be exchanged so that we can then cross-fertilize and bring that information to further places. And second, I want to help people remember that the only time we ever have a big change in society for the better is when enough of us decide we've had enough of it and we insist on something better. When I was young, there was no hope to stop smoking everywhere, and that's changed. It seemed like there was no hope to have gender equity. It's not there yet, but to have same-sex marriage seemed impossible, and look how far we've come. We were talked about a solar in the 60s and the 70s, and we have more progress. One of the positive things we can look for is not just say, we have to say no to LNG and everything. We have to say no to the oil terminal in Vancouver, but mm-hmm. we can also have a vision of what we're saying yes to. We're saying yes to the love and the fairness this coming Sunday. We're saying yes to solutionary rail, where frontline communities get jobs, have a green energy, solar energy empowered, and that we're saying yes to the 1% tax on businesses in
Dee Dee, Oregon. Thank you so much for your call. We're going to get you some more information real quickly. How can folks access some of the learnings and teachings from the trainings?
Yeah, we're going to be launching the website. It's going to go live. It's ojta.org.
Ojta.org.
But if you sign up on the OPPO listserv and get updates on where next trainings are going to be held and ways to learn both about climate justice and environmental justice and the just transition, I think those are other ways we can make sure that the information that was shared gets to and in the hands of community. I would also like to just offer that we don't always have to think about just the movement of the masses, right, to have impact. We've seen in lots of movements, a small handful of people with very strategic interventions have had huge impacts on issues, right? I think the dreamers and folks on campuses, people that are doing stuff in communities, can broaden a narrative and create space that actually does bring out more folks over time. But I wouldn't wait for that, right? I wouldn't wait for the masses to come out, because I think we actually need everyone to think about what they can do with a small group of folks, right? And what impacts can happen on a smaller scale that might actually create the space for more folks to join on.
You're listening to Voices from the Edge. I'm Joseph Santos Lyons here with Shilpa Joshi and Hui Ong. And thanks to also our callers, Camilo, LJ, Carolyn, and Dee Dee, for joining the conversation today. We're going to start talking a little bit more about what's happening in 2018. And Shilpa is with us, who has been a coalition director and lead for some really important work that's coming forward, that's trying to look at ways to transition out of our extractive economy. And there's a bill and a coalition coming together around clean energy jobs, and wanted to just invite Shilpa to say a little bit more about what's been happening.
Excellent, thanks. So the Clean Energy Jobs Coalition is working on a fairly simple concept that there's this huge negative externality in our society that those most responsible for climate change and polluting our planet have not been held responsible for that pollution. So when you and I create trash in our homes, we have to pay the municipality to pick up that trash and take it away. People are fairly comfortable with the idea of having to pay for the waste that they create in some way. But unfortunately, greenhouse gas emissions, which we know now to be the root cause of the massive climate change impacts that we're seeing, no one's checking those and no one's paying for those. And unfortunately, it lets major corporations that do most of that dumping into our atmosphere get away with it. And who pays for it ultimately? It's people like you and me. It's everyday citizens. We pay for it with our rising health costs. We pay for it with displacement, the cost of having to move somewhere else, all the job loss. They're trying to put a number on what the impacts of Houston will be, and it's already in the multiple tens of billions of dollars. It's probably going to creep into the hundreds of billions of dollars. And so that loss becomes a public responsibility. However, the profits that companies make off of that pollution is privatized. So we don't get to see the money that they're making until now, this policy, mm-hmm. but we do have to all pay for the losses in many, many ways, and we'll continue to have to do so. So this is, as I said, we have a fortune of having really strong elected officials in our state, and we're encouraging them to put a price on our largest polluters in the state. So we're talking the really, really big emitters, those companies that emit over 25,000 tons of greenhouse gases a year or higher in the state will have to purchase permits to pollute. And then in buying those permits, we will have a greenhouse gas reduction fund that is set up that will create a really great source of funding for job training, clean energy projects, lots of really exciting things across the state. We're really looking at what rural communities need, what communities of color need, what communities already impacted by climate change need. Since natural resources and timber industries have drained out of the state in the last 50, 60 years, we haven't seen a major industry or industries really take that place. And unemployment and all of the problems that spring from that are skyrocketing in our rural counties and in our communities of color. And so we have a responsibility and we have an opportunity to bring those reinvestments back to places that deeply need them. So one of the things that I talk about in this fight, in this campaign to put a price on pollution and reinvest in the solutions, which is called the Clean Energy Jobs Campaign, is that Oregon, the wind and solar industry and geothermal industries and all these exciting industries are not waiting for Oregon to decide that we're the next place they want to, you know, they want to invest, they want to bring all those jobs here. They will go to Colorado, they will go to California, they're already in California. So it's about making our state the place where those economies can really take hold once again. 10, 15 years ago, we were the place where the clean energy economy was starting to pick up, and that really isn't the case anymore. So we have to make it so. We do have a bill that our coalition has been working on. It's a coalition of environmental groups, grassroots organization, community of color organizations, rural advocates, low-income housing advocates, tribes, labor, public health, and business. And we've been coming together to develop a concept that will, as I said, put a price on pollution and invest in communities that need it most. In its first year, if it's passed in the 2018 session, the bill will raise $700 million that will go towards projects for that have a co-benefit. So they are projects that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions while creating jobs. That's the nexus that we're looking at when we're thinking of project development. And so the more we get out into communities, the more we talk to our coalition partners and broader advocates, the more ideas surface. We were just in Pendleton a few weeks ago, and we were talking with people that work closely with farmers and agriculture industry, and one of their biggest burdens. So naively, I went out there as an advocate from Portland, thinking, "Wow, we passed a lot of wind turbines. Maybe people want to install more wind out here." And then they said, "Well, no, actually, we're experiencing a lot of drought conditions, and so one of the things that we'd really like to do is install modern irrigation systems that have little hydro inside the pipe. So as water flows over it, it creates energy. And so you're saving hundreds of thousands of dollars in energy for farmers. You're saving a ton of water, and you're creating new jobs in the clean energy industry." And we're like, that sounds perfect. So this is the sort of thing that we're working on. We have a really powerful coalition moving into the 5-week session next year. And I'll pause there so you can ask questions.
Yeah, no, thanks for the really deep overview. And just to sort of bring it down to a personal level for a minute. So I grew up in North Portland. We had Oregon steel mills and other places that really were polluting for a long time, and there were campaigns to really cut that pollution, but they never really paid. And I think I had asthma for a while. I had other friends who had asthma. We had to pay our healthcare bills and such. When you talk about the price of pollution from these big emitters, these big polluters, is that partly what you're talking about? Is that these dollars that are paid into the state fund, the $700 million potentially, in the if the bill passes, would go back to invest in our communities that are affected by pollution?
Yeah, that's exactly what we're looking at. So we're looking at low-income weatherization and energy efficiency as one of the big tracks that we want the funding to go to statewide. We know that many low-income residents in the state live in not stable housing conditions. And sometimes it's when Oregon Coast Community Action, which is a group that we work with, or NeighborWorks Umpqua in Roseburg, goes out to look at assess a home before they offer to help pay the utility bill, what they find is that people aren't just defaulting on their bill because they can't pay it. It's because there's a massive hole in the roof, or, you know, there's a window missing or something like that. And so what we're looking at is creating the dollars to really bring these homes up to speed, particularly on the coast, particularly in areas that are going to see worsening storms and conditions. We need to have more energy efficient and safer homes for people to live in, and that are using less energy. So that's definitely one of the ways that we're making sure this money is coming back to communities that are already impacted.
So I also want to be clear, you know, Apano has been a part of, I think, this process. I know Opal's been engaged. Our organizations may not have yet seen the full bill and seen, so we haven't fully endorsed, but I think we're very much interested in solutions to these issues. And I know that there's also some concerns and some challenges to figure out the right policy concept, the right framework that's going to make this move forward. I know that California and Washington have also been moving on issues like this. What are we seeing in those states, Shilpa? What's happening in Washington? What's happening in California? And how does Oregon connect to this sort of larger effort to create both clean energy jobs and to address the carbon emissions?
So the concept that Oregon is working on is a cap and trade system. And what we've seen in California was an early adopter of this program over 10 years ago. And what we've really seen is that there are a lot of ways to do it not so great for impacted communities. California, I think, out the gate did not have communities of color and environmental justice communities involved in that decision-making process and ultimately where the dollars raised would go for investments, and gave away a lot of free allowances to corporations so that they didn't see the emissions reductions that communities that were sitting next to those polluting entities really needed to see from that program. And so we've really taken that into serious consideration as we're about to, you know, start going into the process of making this bill a real thing. Holding companies accountable is going to be critical, and making sure that investments get to the people that need it most is going to be, those are our two biggest priorities as a coalition. And so we are continuing in, and then in Washington, similarly, the Alliance for Jobs and Clean Energy is working closely with communities of color to work on a ballot measure, I believe. And so they're also working to put a price on greenhouse gas pollution in the state.
Okay. John, do we have another caller? Nope. All right. Hui, what are your thoughts right now?
Yeah, I think it's actually been pretty exciting to hear that there's a movement to address in a way that created space for frontline communities and folks of color to really weigh in and learn and see the complexity of addressing greenhouse gas emissions and what happens in Oregon has impact in other states. So I think, you know, OPAL, Environmental Justice Oregon, is you know, working closely to figure out what this impact would have on our communities. I think when Shilpa shares that, you know, there's that fact, or when you were sharing that there, you know, people that live next to places of polluters, you know, people want to see reduction, right? They don't, you know, I mean, some folks don't go so deep into the weeds around the policy itself. They want to see how does this, you know, fundamentally benefit their communities, their, you know, their families and their health. And one thing we want to do over at OPAL Environmental Justice is both, you know, because the policy isn't fully written, and we're in conversations about, you know, the positives and challenges of market-based solutions, and what does that mean globally, right? As we have impact on what we decide in Oregon, what might have impact on folks across the nation, right? So, you know, we're struggling with it, and I think it's a good struggle. I think it's something that we want to continue the deep conversation, and, you know, Shilpa's been really great about creating space for, you know, deep dives and kind of, you know, getting into the weeds and the wonkiness, which is good, right? And I think, you know, having relationships with folks in Washington and in California and folks that are, you know, looking at other models, it's good to have those voices in the room, because I think we can't just look at what's the benefit in Oregon, right? I think, you know, we have to look at, you know, far beyond. It's also the same thing we always say, like, we can't just think about solutions in Portland, right? We have to think about solutions that has real impact in rural communities. And I think we have to broaden that even further. And for, you know, an organization that has a base, you know, in the Portland metro area, it's a challenging lift, right? That's why we think the Alliance is a good space to be able to, you know, deepen relationships and analysis with folks.
Thank you so much, Shilpa and Hui, for joining me today. We're going to wrap up in about 1 or 2 minutes. This is Voices from the Edge. I'm Joseph Santos Lyons. We're on KBOO 90.7 FM. Thanks so much for listening in to us today. I'll be here for the month of September every Thursday, 8 a.m. with some other amazing organizer special guests. And before we go, just wanted to ask Shilpa and Hui just to share maybe just a word about what keeps you grounded during these times. We've been talking about some, both the heaviness and the big issues that we're facing here in this world and feeling, I think, the direct effects of climate change today, but also looking to some bigger dreams and some potentially, you know, major changes here in the state. So you know, I know we talked a little bit about kids and thinking about hope, but anything else you want to add?
Yeah. So what keeps me grounded is friends that are like family and my family, and making, cooking food with people and sitting down and eating it.
Excellent.
And working on solutions.
I would echo that. I think, you know, I've been able to be around people that are both visionary and taking action. And, you know, we have youth members that are around the office, which is super empowering because they see that they have impact. They see that they are, you know, when folks see their own power, it's pretty powerful.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Chopin.
And I just wanted to encourage anyone who'd like to get involved with the Clean Energy Jobs Campaign to check out reneworegon.org. And if you want more information on the organizing happening around DACA, to check out Causa Oregon. And Apano actually has been really on that as well.
Excellent. And also a shout out to opalpdx.org if you want to get signed up for the Opal list. So reneworegon.org and opalpdx.org. Take care, everybody.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
Good morning, it's 8:58 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. The weather is calling for a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms, but mostly cloudy, smoky, and ashy today with a high near 80. Coming up in just about 2 minutes, Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. It's Press Watch at 9:30 on Fight the Empire. A look back at Brzezinski's brilliant idea to back Afghan Islamists in order to give the Soviet Union their own Vietnam. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia. Chris Andre brings you headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, we have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Jacqueline Woodson's latest novel, Another Brooklyn, is a poetic tale of four African-American girls growing up in 1970s New York. And at 11:30, on Black Book Talk, Portland novelist Renee Watson talks about her new collaboration, Before Betty X, about the early life of Malcolm X's wife. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
Donald Trump is no billionaire. He just plays one on TV. This is Greg Palast. On September 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO presents at the Clinton Theater the latest version of my new film. It's the world premiere of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, How Trump Stole It. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, featuring Rosario Dawson, Willie Nelson, Richard Belzer, Ice-T, and Ed Asner as Santa Claus. That's The Best Democracy Money Can Buy world premiere of the new edition, How Trump Stole It. Again, that's KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater, presenting The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, How Trump Stole It, September 14th at 7 p.m., 2922 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. This is Greg Palast reporting.